The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
Sure enough, the ref was over. What's your name? And him talking to me for all match the ref. He's the captain for Trouser, and he's chatting to me. I'm loving the Paddy set. Paddy Andrews, red card.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
OTB AM. With Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
Hello, good morning. Welcome to OTB AM. It's Friday morning. It's gone 7:30. Delighted to have you along with us. Pack show coming up. Owen Shane alongside me in studio. Morning, Owen.
Morning, Adrian. How are you getting on?
Freshish from the Aviva.
Freshish from the Aviva, correct. Yeah, hopped on the bandwagon last night.
How was it? You had your black and red scarf on you, obviously.
Yeah. The occasional time I tend to go. It was great. It was great to be at a... with all these sort of things, from being at being fortunate enough to be at Thurles last weekend to being at the Aviva last night, it feels normal, to be honest. It doesn't feel like you're missing the thousands of empty seats or the thousands of would-be spectators on either side of things, whether it's Munster football or Conference League football, as it were. It feels that this is just right again, and everything seems all right with the world. It's just different to, because maybe we would have also been lucky enough to go to a few games and sit in the press box in these empty places. It's just different to actually go as a spectator and as a fan, because I think you can
have a few pints.
Well, exactly. You can have pints. No, but it won't feel normal until pints resume at games. That's still a bit away, it seems, at this point.
So you couldn't have a drink last night?
Well, you could beforehand and afterwards, yeah. But at the game, no, that's not how they're operating at the moment.
Okay, so we'll
you're not interested in going to the Aviva anytime soon, is what you're saying.
If you can't have the wine and cheese board at your seat on, that's you know. The I was looking at some of the clips last night and did feel like there's been all this chat sort of ever since this craziness kicked off, that there would come a moment where we'd all go, okay, that's great, it's over. Obviously, that we're not there yet, but it did feel like last night was a bit of an outpouring of all the things you were talking about in terms of people feeling normal again.
Yeah, I think so. I think the people who are genuine Bows fans, the people who go to the games all the time, I'm very much an outsider looking in on that fan culture, very much on the bandwagon for last night. It's great to actually just witness other people being able to spend time with people that they have a very deep shared love with. These people who are there in the black and red and who are supporters of this team throughout their entire life, who don't just play a passing interest with because they happen to live in the north side of Dublin, who've been through everything, really, who've seen everything, and all of a sudden, their first time back after, 16 months to actually see their team live, is a European night on Lansdowne Road where you've smashed some Icelandic team 3-0. Like, it did seem like dreamland for people who are massive supporters of the club. And it was, as somebody who was on the outside looking in, as I say, kind of enjoyable to see that level of emotion and that love pouring out, like even just walking kind of around afterwards, just seeing people in and around that area of Dublin again that are sports fans was a good thing. Now I'm saying that and I'm thinking to myself, I probably haven't been in and around that area of Dublin since I think the Wales game in the Six Nations at the start of 2020, so it was kind of a first for a lot of us, and yeah. it was just a really nice experience.
And people are trying to get a fix on how good is that 3-0 win against Stjarnan. And as Neil O'Riordan points out in The Sun this morning, that it's only 8 or 9 years ago that Bows were getting beaten 5-1 by a team from the Icelandic second division. So, that definitely puts it in good context. He also, and there's a point in here from Dara O'Toole on YouTube saying the scenes in Bald's Bridge beforehand where a Delta variant come true, kind of worrying to see. And I mentioned Neil O'Riordan, he also makes reference to it in his article in The Sun this morning, to say that social distancing wasn't always a thing. And casual approach to wearing face masks as well. What was your experience of it?
Well, I was at the other end of the ground. I can literally distance myself from that to where the true fans were. And I'm not going to sit here and say that it was observed perfectly, because anybody who saw the game on television last night would know that would be a lie. And people were, of course, gathered in close proximity behind the goal in the stand that is generally the stand where you'd have like the singing section at Ireland games and all that sort of thing. So of course they were gathered closely. It seemed like an incredible atmosphere, to be honest. The first thing I was thinking was, that's an incredible atmosphere. And then of course you start to think there might be a bit of a blowback to this. There were a couple of announcements on the PA saying please put on your face masks, please social distance, and they happened on multiple times.
Was there any reaction to that you could see, or?
Like, I mean, again, not particularly. I was literally at the other end of the stadium to actually see, was there a reaction? I think, like, I mean, I don't know, to be honest. It's a hard thing to try, and you can't put the genie back in the bottle, so to speak, once people are gathering, and once your team is 2-0 up and then 3-0 up, and it's just this euphoric night. It's an extremely hard thing to control. Like, I did think that the way that the event was set up, the stewarding, the way people are looked after, I thought was, like, exceptional by and large from my own personal experience, and maybe it then gets to a stage of personal responsibility at that point where, of course, I'm going to be able to walk from here to 100 yards over there, because that's what happens in a massive stadium, and it's up to me whether or not I want to do that thing. And, I mean, I do think that there is a little bit of give and a little bit of take where you're given certain parameters and you've kind of got to exist within it. Yeah. And, yeah, anybody watching the game on TV last night, I'm sure it came up on TV, would be able to see what the scenes were like behind that goal. But I'm not going to lie, my first thought was, God, it's a cracking atmosphere down the other end of the stadium. I kind of want to be down there, sort of thing, but I did not venture.
Yeah, very difficult, and certainly, like you say, not to sit in judgment over it. It'll be interesting to see the reaction of it, and, like, even in terms of the stewards, it's impossible to, even with a crowd of that size, to corral everybody to say, listen, you got to follow these things. But yeah, they're obviously been held as semi-test events at the minute, so I'm sure there will be some reaction to that, without any question.
Completely, and that is the thing. They are test events. Like, it's interesting how much burden there is being put on stewards during these games. I think, like, even the experience in Thurles last Saturday night for the Gaelic football was very much stewards kind of keeping a hawk eye on you and telling you to put on your mask if it's not on. And the same experience actually was there in the Aviva last night. In fairness, the stewards always face the crowd at the Aviva, so it's a bit more normal where you people looking up at you, and they would remind you to put on your face mask if you weren't there. I mean, obviously you're sitting outside and you're in your pod, but they're obviously trying to do everything on their end of things. Sort of being like, well, we've done our bit, we've done as best as we can, and again, like, as I say, the PA announcements that were coming through the stadium and all that, what can you do when you're in that situation if people aren't following the guidelines to the letter of the law, you know?
Well, that's the point, that no matter how good the stewards are, that's exactly right. If a group of people decide that they're not going to do that thing, there's very little you can do. Like, pointing at them and telling them to put the mask on is only going to be so effective.
Yeah, and I think that there is an element of personal responsibility that it comes down to, but I don't think that's kind of dominating things today. Like, as you say, it's like you only have to go back a few years to them getting beaten well by an Icelandic team. I think it's the first time they've played in Lansdowne Road in 29 years as a football club, and then you're kind of like being behind the goal, you don't necessarily get a great appreciation for what's happening on the other end. But the flip side is when the play is happening right in front of you, you get a phenomenal appreciation for what's happening right in front of you. And I was fortunate enough to be, I don't know, 20 metres away from Dawson Devoy with that incredible assist for the opening goal last night. And this kid is just phenomenal. This could be a big weekend for Meath sport. And the boy from Ashburn might have got it underway in stunning fashion last night.
I think it's all downhill from here on, won't lie to you. Yeah. But, I mean, it depends on what you think success is. Like, you know, 6-point loss to Dublin suddenly is a pretty good thing. And so the football was good. And obviously the societal sort of, we're all back, and that's great. But the football, the 3-0 was by all accounts fully deserved.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was. I'm not sure was this what people were expecting, to be honest. I don't think. I think after the first leg, there was all even talk beforehand about the away goals don't exist anymore, so it could be extra time penalties here. And all of a sudden it became very apparent. There was maybe a few shaky moments after they go 1-0 up where you're starting to think, are they going to do the classic thing for any team, that is, of sitting back on the lead a little bit? And there was a few moments of possession for the opposition, but there was never any incision and never any opportunity that you thought, right, okay, this is going to be a very shaky lead. And then halftime came at a good time, came out in the second half and blew them away, really. And those people behind the goals, the real supporters, had just like this incredible night. And what a way to return to Lansdowne Road after almost 30 years of not being there. And like, I mean, you want to see those scenes in Dalymount ASAP, of course, but this isn't a bad middle ground for the time being.
Yeah, only the second time they've ever played at Lansdowne Road.
Oh, right, is that it? Okay.
Like, for a club of Bohemians' longevity and size, I thought that was unbelievable.
Yeah, and like, the Conference League, I mean, how much of a difference does it make to the standard of team you're playing when they would have been in Europa League anyway, and they played Icelandic opposition, as you mentioned there, a few years ago anyway. But I do think that there is maybe more of a... there's more of a level playing field from an Irish perspective here, that there will be an opportunity to go deeper into these competitions. There's just more European spots going in general. There's more prize money in general, which, as we know, isn't forthcoming from their own domestic league. This is really important going into the future for all of these clubs on an existential level, quite possibly. So there are just so many positives that you can take from a night like that last night, and hopefully there's more of them to come.
And also, like, they should have had how's the name of this tournament a bit better, I have to say. Like, including the word conference in anything is really just stinking the joint out. They surely could have come up with something a bit sexier than that. It's awful. By the way, the I know that, you know, on back of the Star this morning, I don't know if you can get a good... people who are watching us this morning can get a look at that Bri baby on the back of it. Like... who does it look like? It's an incredible likeness, and I know that like he didn't have great success off the shot tracker yesterday, but there's really no need to splash Brian O'Driscoll's picture on the back of the Star, and he's on the Telegraph and a lot of other. He's Bryson DeChambeau in that photograph particularly is a doppelganger for our own Brian O'Driscoll, it has to be said. But poor old Bryson didn't have a great day of it himself, it has to be said. He's had a bit of a set to. It's not what you want. And particularly for Bryson DeChambeau, who spends the vast majority of his post-round interviews thanking his sponsors and all the people who are giving him lots and lots of the moolah. He didn't really remember his own lessons last night, where he said that his Cobra driver after his first round at the Open, it sucks. Was his review of that. Look, and I think we've all come to know that Bryson DeChambeau is not necessarily that keen on placing himself. Almost talking about personal responsibility here. This is not somebody who places a huge amount of importance on his own failings rather than the people and the equipment that are around him. But Bryson DeChambeau really, he said, if I can hit it down the middle of the fairway, that's great. But with the driver right now, the driver sucks. It's not a good face for me, and we're trying to figure out how to make it good on the miss hits. I'm living at the razor's edge, like I've told people for a long time. So this is just like, you know, anything that's gone bad for me over the last while, well, that's not really my doing. That's at the door of Cobra, who've designed this, I mean, lovely piece of equipment. But the Cobra have had their say on.
Yeah.
They're not happy. They've had loads to say in response to him, and I'm going to grab those quotes now. But... I go on.
In fairness, there was going to be one golfer who got into a spat with equipment, and the equipment was going to have a spat back at him. It was always going to be Bryson DeChambeau.
Ben Showman, on who we're all very familiar with, obviously from Cobra. He's the operations manager.
And who caddied for Bryson?
He caddied for Bryson
at the Rocket Mortgage Classic.
Oh, okay, right. Like as a sort of hey sponsor. It's just really, really painful when Bryson says something so that's stupid. Said Ben. He has never really been happy ever. It's like an 8-year-old that gets mad at you. They might fly off the handle and say, I hate you, but then you go, whoa. No, you don't. We know as adults that they really don't mean that. And I know that if I got Bryson cornered right now, he says, flicking onto the page 2 here, and said, what the hell did you say that for? He would say to me that he was mad. He really didn't mean to say it that harshly. He knows how much everyone bends over backwards for him, but it's still not cool. This is an incredible war of words between, like, two people who you would think... And by the way, sorry, the Telegraph as well. I mean, it's Brian O'Driscoll. Two people who really, yeah, should be an awful lot tighter than this. Ben Showman's quotes from Cobra really jumped out at me as, like, you know, a partner who they've really not been happy for a long, long time, and they've been waiting for their opportunity to say it. And they also had to say it, I think, because ultimately there's a lot of golfers around, like literally millions of golfers around the world listening to Bryson DeChambeau, and like, you know, his take on the Cobra, most of them would have had no appreciation of whether the Cobra is good, bad or indifferent for him. They just know that this guy hits it off the tee miles when he's holding a Cobra, and they're probably going to go and get themselves some of that good stuff until he says, nah, it's crap.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
They've very much bespoke when it comes to the design for Bryson DeChambeau. It's a 46-inch shaft, only 5 degrees of loft, this is a specific creation by Cobra for Bryson, but you suspect it's a specific creation by Bryson for Bryson, and Cobra are merely the middlemen in all of this. So I think that he's perhaps taking his anger out in the wrong way here a little bit. Of course, you're going to be a little bit annoyed with your clubs, but God, I don't know. This is a pretty spectacular way to do it, to be honest, when everybody knows that you've got a huge degree of control over the exact type of club that you're using. You have been shown to be the scientist of golf, and you have had as much input as anybody else in that science. And I think you are as to blame, Mr. DeChambeau, for how this has gone as much as Cobra. He said it's literally the physics and the way that they build heads now is what Bryson was saying. So the physics, yeah. It's science's fault.
Well, like, Ben Showman is spot on, by the way. Like, he is an 8-year-old, and whatever about at that time going, oh my God, I can't believe the drivers let me down and thumping onto the ground or whatever, like, saving it until the post-match interview, what part of his mind was thinking, oh, this is going to be a great idea? And also, what an insight into this guy, like, who you would think at that elite level, for a player who has and will and continue to compete at the highest of levels of golf, right? Like, the mindset that gets you there to begin with, obviously all the stuff he's done over the last while would indicate to me some level of awareness of how he's involved in making himself good, right? Like, he's changed his body shape. You're talking about obviously all the science that he puts into it, which is a long-standing thing for him. He's placing, at least in part, himself at the centre of the solution of his own stuff. And then suddenly to have this sort of, I mean, I just don't know what's going through his head that he thinks is going to, I'll just do this interview, I'll say the equipment and the millions that they're paying me to use it, I'm sure, sucks. And everything's going to be fine after that. I don't know what sort of an insight it is into Bryson DeChambeau. But we'll see. His likeness of Brian O'Driscoll is a thing that's that's really got me there.
Brian O'Driscoll, of course, swinging clubs in Sky Sports yesterday. It was.
I didn't see that bit, Jeff.
Yeah, it was on screen. Asked to take a drive, and unfortunately his drive just went off to the left, and it's clearly something that he knew was coming, and the presenter's like, oh, is that something that it kind of flies off the face of the club a bit, and Brian's like, every time, you know. And there was almost this moment of I need to sort this out on live television, which was a little bit unfortunate. I'm not sure were they hoping for people to step up and hit the ball in a long straight line, but I'd say fair play for going on and actually bashing the ball out. So we can confirm that is a photograph of Bryson DeChambeau. It isn't Brian O'Driscoll after appearing on Sky Sports yesterday.
The other thing, just to touch on before we're going to have talk to Gordon Darcy in just a couple of moments about the lines, is Declan O'Sullivan less likely to become the Kerry senior manager this morning, or does last night make no difference?
I don't know, to be honest. I wouldn't say he's less likely. He's built up quite an impressive CV. He would have been thought certainly in the pack of people who might be the next Kerry manager. The question is when does the job ever come up, and what is success for this bunch of under-20s? Because I don't know. You can obviously say, oh well, all those minors. Where's your conveyor belt at now? Considering you haven't been able to convert those into under-20s All-Irelands. But success, regardless of whether you're winning All-Irelands at that level or not, is how many of those players actually step up to make it into the senior team. And over the last few years, there has been a multitude of those players who've got an All-Ireland medal at minor level who have made the step up to the senior team. They're clearly not being lost at under-20 level. They may not be winning All-Ireland titles, or in this case, not winning Munster titles, but they're still being brought through in a way that allows them to step up to senior level pretty well. Now, of course, there have been some exceptional circumstances where some of them haven't been allowed to play under-21 level or under-20 level, with O'Shea and Clifford being the obvious examples. But somebody like Paul O'Shea last night, who is an outstanding talent and got league time for Kerry in this year's league, he's like, you would think that they're being looked after in the right way and they're being asked to play football in the right way. And that's kind of the job. I mean, the All-Irelands and the Munster titles are kind of a bonus, as important as they would seem in isolation last night. So the question around Declan O'Sullivan will be, what do the players look like after they come out from under his wing? And I think the evidence so far is that they've all looked pretty good and they've all looked like they're senior ready. So I would say that his position as a future Kerry manager hasn't been damaged too much. But yeah, you still never want to see them lose the core.
Yeah, and look, it's a different brief, obviously, the bringing through of talent versus the being able to manage it senior. And the job could be coming up, obviously, in 6 or 7 weeks if Kerry don't get the job done.
Next week.
Could be, exactly. So the job could be coming up very soon indeed. And there's plenty of interesting names have been touted around in the mix for it. But it'll be Cork against Tip in the Munster Under 20 final, and Dublin against Offaly. Dublin swatted away Meath, as will be the theme for the weekend. 6 points the difference last night, and Westmeath came up a couple of points short against Offaly after the heroics, obviously, on as we went into a deep dive on last week. So that was the Under 20 Championship. We'll have more GAA, but later on we're going to do our quick picks. But you are watching at 7.50 on this Friday morning. You're watching OTB AM, brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Here is what's coming up for you on the show this morning. We're going to talk rugby in just a couple of moments' time. Gordon Darcy standing by, so we're going to chat to him about Lions and plenty more besides. Daniel Harris is going to talk to us to further pick through the bones of the England penalty shootout defeat and all the reaction there's been to that, and some speculation as well. A couple of big names potentially on the way to Old Trafford. I'm sure he'll have thoughts on that too, and ahead of the start of the new season as well, which is just a month away. GA quick picks, Will and Tommy are going to join us on the line for that. I'm still top of the table is kind of the short story on that. Owen's come up with a new convoluted mechanic that's basically aimed at trying to get me off it. We'll see how that works out. We'll bring you the sports headlines at 10 to 9. After that, live crappy quiz at 10 past 9. Myself against Nathan, against Will. And then we'll bring you some Gaelic football chat ahead of a big weekend, obviously, as well. So that'll be coming your way at about 9:30 this morning. So that is what's going on in the show. There's plenty of comments coming into us, and please do keep them in over the course of this morning. But we're turning to rugby now. Gordon Darcy, good morning to you.
Good morning. How are we getting on?
Good. You're looking very fresh for a man who's it's 5 days to lift off, am I right?
Yeah, well, I'm a seven-month-old, so my day started a few hours ago.
Tell us about your doing a 850-kilometre cycle across 4 days for Bairdstown.
Yeah. So I suppose one of the things a lot of people did during lockdown was start getting into exercise. And I started doing a fair bit of cycling. I did got a watt bike in the side passage when we were stuck inside the 2K and the 5K. And I suppose it's been a while since I really pushed myself, and I decided I was going to do something. So I kind of sat down and kind of mapped out a few different ideas. And what I'm doing is I'm going around, I'm starting in Lansdowne, I'm going through 9 AIL rugby clubs, a little bit of community, all socially, all COVID compliant, and just calling into some clubs, trying to build a bit of community spirit, trying to get little kids involved to help fundraise for less fortunate little kids. And I've been a patron of Bairdstown and an ambassador for them for forever. So the two things kind of came together.
Yeah, they do incredible work for kids that are living with serious illness, and we're going to give the details of how people can get involved as well in a moment. But how long have you been training, and what sort of stage are you at now? Is it that sort of tapering down phase, or are you still?
Yeah. So I've done all the hard work. I did last Tuesday. I did a kind of a volume day, which was like about 120k in about five, kind of broken up over 5 hours. So I'll need to do that. I'm going to be averaging for the first 3 days. First 2 days is 250k a day. The second day it's 200k, and then it's the balance then on the last day to try and get back before the first Lions test. So I have a really good coach, Scott, who's been helping me out, because I'm not made for cycling. I'm made for running into big people. So this endurance thing is something new, and that's actually the bit I really enjoy, which is actually the mental challenge as well as the physical challenge. The physical challenge is going to having a sore arse for 4 days, and then the mental bit is being on the road on my own. My brother's amazing. He's driving a car, and just a quick shout out to Windsor Motor, who are giving me a car to drive, but it's pretty much just me, myself, and I on the road. My brother to give me a cup of coffee along the way. So Ian, thanks very much, you're a legend. And that's it. Like, it's just a bit of fun, and all the clubs have just been amazing. I actually can't say enough to all the clubs. They've all got so engaged. Some of them are going to cycle out or back in like a kilometre or two with me, but like, I'm from Wexford community clubs. It's all about the people in the clubs, and all these clubs have just been fantastic. So really I can't thank them enough It's like Lanzen, Nace, Nina, Garryowen, Galwegians, Roscommon, Craigs, yeah, up to Dungannon, Belfast, Harlequins, Dundalk, and then to Bardstown. So it's a fair old clip, and everybody's really getting involved, which is great.
Yeah, that first clip, I'm knackered if I ever have to drive that length in a car. So I can only imagine. Did you say 120 kilometres? What's been your longest, given that you were doing 250 for the first couple of days? What's your longest spin out so far?
It's been about 250k.
Right, you've done it, so.
I have done it. I just haven't done it 3 days in a row.
Yeah. That's where the tough bit kicks in. And you've over €5,000 raised already. we're going to put up the Just Giving link on our own social pages this morning. People can check out your own social handle as well, I'm sure, for progress over the few days. And we will be checking in with you again as well. So listen, best of luck on that front, and well done, obviously, as well. Talk to us a little bit about the rugby, obviously, Lions coming up this weekend and all in the lead into the first test. I was interested in the post-match interviews the other night with Conor Murray and Mauro Itoje, particularly, where they were asked about the return of Alan Wynne-Jones, and they both had a grin sort of coming across their face that maybe they didn't necessarily want to be there, but it said to me that maybe personally they weren't really that encouraging of Alan Wynne-Jones coming back into it. I'm sure that's, obviously, it's not what they said, and I'm sure within the camp it's not what they'll say either. But is it all positive that he's coming back in, Gordon, or any chance that it, because it was it's unexpected, that it upsets the apple cart?
It couldn't be any more COVID, could it? I think this is, like, COVID is going to become a verb, or it's going to become something that we, the urban dictionaries, and eventually end up in the Weber one, won't it? It's one of those things. You have to see him on the football field. He comes back in. I presume he comes back in as tour captain, and he has to play. And if he proves he comes back in, I don't think Itoje has a huge amount to worry. I think given the way this Lions has gone, there's a lot of players are going to be playing. They may not be playing in their preferred position, but given the way that Itoje played on Wednesday, he was one of the guys that was matching the South African emerging Springboks on Wednesday. I don't think out of all the players so far that you can leave him out. And I think, Conor Murray, this, the captaincy thing and everything, has been so distracting for him. And and the game didn't go his way on Wednesday night, and I think the physicality that the Springboks brought versus the lack of tempo that the Lions brought, it really didn't play to Conor's strength. So I think it was more, from Conor Murray's perspective, he's just there going, I had played my last game ahead of the first test, and I didn't put my best foot forward.
Yeah, it's possible that the other side of it is that he's secretly delighted that, because you're even looking at him on the practical side of being a captain on the pitch the other night, and there's times where he just looks like, understandably, by the way, because he's never done the job before, that he just doesn't know how he should be talking to the referee or how he should behave.
Yeah, you can see Owen Farrell was already doing it before he even kind of went to do it. But that wasn't the kind of captain he was picked for. He was picked as a tour captain. We kind of talked with this the last time, guys, that he can allow those guys to fill in the gaps. But the prerequisite was that he was hitting form.
Yeah.
And I think the challenge he has is that the game needed a spark, and he was playing very much the game he's been playing for Munster and for Ireland, which was a tempo-ish game and very box-score driven, and he didn't really try to increase the tempo or change or do anything. And you got to wonder, with the way Gatland has talked about Ali Price and the way he's talked about Davies, is that going to hurt them? Because if one of those pulls the proverbial rabbit out of a hat now on at the weekend, where does that leave him?
Yeah, Tommy Bowe, I know last night, was very much of the opinion that it's Murray all the way, but we'll see. What's your 10, 12, 13 access for the first test?
I think Bundy struggled in the physical stakes, and has done well in the midweek games. But once you came up against Delande, you came up against 6'5" back rowers, I don't think he had the same impact on it. I think Henshaw, there was chatter before that game that, maybe he's out of sight, out of mind. I think Henshaw comes straight back in. I think he has to be the 12 that starts. I think bigger And that bigger and Farrell access and Finn Russell and Farrell access won't really work because both of those like to play with a traditional 12, and Farrell isn't a traditional 12. He's not a guy that you can, if you're a 10, you can carry the line, something's not on, you can drop it off to him. He is a second playmaker, and I don't think they're used to playing with those type of players. So I don't think Farrell really is in that 12 equation. 13-1 for me is really, really interesting. I go a little bit left field on this one. I think Harris, everything but passing, was really, really good against the Springbok, the emerging box. Had his passing be a little bit crisper, I think the Lions could have actually been in that game. And that's a big, big skill deficit to have going into that. So I think he's potentially a safe choice, but I actually think Elliot Daly could slot in there. I thought he looked really comfortable. And starting to find form. And thing about Lions tour is sometimes you're going to find players that come out of left field and actually play with a bit of form, and you have to find positions for them. So in the same conversation is Otoje is going to start. He's going to be in there. Elliot Daly, I think, could be a potential option at 13.
We had Robbie Hench on the show before he flew out, Gordon, and he was saying that the difference between 12 and 13 is more negligible than ever at the moment, that you kind of need to be able to play both because you might be popping up in both positions throughout the game. Is that what you're seeing in this Lions tour so far in terms of the patterns of play?
Yeah. Like, there's an awful lot of kicking, and the opportunities to counter and actually play some footy seem to be quite small at the moment. So that does fit into exactly what Robbie's saying, is like the positions have become a little bit homogenized, and they're, you know, you're asking for the same skill set and you're asking for them to do the kind of same roles within one channels. But I think when you look at the difference between, say, what South Africa did at various points when they got over the game line, their kicking and their ability to play their game plan, which was very kicking orientated, was an awful lot more effective than, say, the Lions, because they struggled to get over the game line. But I do think when the way the Lions have to play and the way we've seen them looking to play is with that bit of pace and bit of tempo. And I do think you need a ball player in that 12 and 13 thing. I don't think you can have you can have a skill deficit there. You need somebody there that is able to get crisp passes away, particularly for Zamet. That almost try that he had that ball been not, you know, in the air for nearly 2 seconds, he scores that try. And that was, you know, and it's probably being a bit harsh on Harris, but you've got to be able to put those passes away. And I think someone like a Henshaw or a Daly is going to get those passes. Even if you take 0.5 of a second off those, or half a second off that, it's in the air for 1.5 seconds, he scores that try. He is that good of a player. So I think, I think the point of differentiation, the easy thing is to say, listen, we're just going to pick two smash and bash guys. We're going to be really physical, but you need to have that. You need to have either that ability to pass the ball, which Henshaw and I think Daly have particularly.
You mentioned the kicking game there on both sides. How impressed or otherwise have you been with how the Lions have approached that department?
You can just see, you're still seeing elements of the guys coming from the four different countries and the way they kick. You know, when it clicks, it's great, but you can still see the tempo, the way they go. The English guys are very, very good at chasing down the box kicks. But there's been so much disruption. You have wingers going to fullbacks. You have wingers going into the, like, it has been all over the place. I do, like, particularly on Wednesday, I think we got a very good insight that the physical, if you really, really attack the breakdown against the Lions, they will slow down and they will box kick. And I think that's playing into the South African hands. So, and I don't think the Lions executed particularly well. So I think you get this false sense of security against some of the South African teams. You think, oh, the South Africans are going to be good. We saw in the Rainbow Cup, they're not always that good. And some of the teams that we've played up to this point, they haven't been that good. And then you get the first of the four tests, and I don't think we even got parity in the air.
On Robbie Henshaw, Gordon, he's coming fast up on the rail for Ireland's best number 12. He's been in incredible form over the last year. Have you seen form like it, and what, is there something changed about him, about his game, about his style? What are your thoughts on that?
I think he's just, I think you can get certain periods in your career where you're comfortable things and where you kind of, you know, you pass that point of almost caring and trying to please too many people. And he just seems like he's taking huge ownership of his game and not trying to be everything. You know, when he played at 13, he had, not 15, he had everything, had the kicking game and had, you know, there was so many facets to his game. But the game around him has changed, and you need to be not a jack of all trades or even good at all bits. You need to be really, really strong with, you know, one or two, three elements of it. And his physicality, his defense, his reading and defense has been phenomenal. And his ball carrying has been phenomenal. And then the small little subtle passing and the offloads and things have been brilliant. He has just hit that groove. And when you're in that, it looks effortless. You know, you talk about this, Ed McNulty would often talk about this, you know, that flow state where things are happening because you've done all the training, subconsciously you're primed, you're ready, your reads are good, and it all becomes this kind of self-fulfilling or virtuous circle. And it's really, really good to watch when you have a player like that in form because it looks effortless. They look like they have time on the ball. They look like their reads are, they're a step earlier than there, but it's confidence. So he's playing with confidence. He's earned it. He's had an unlucky period with injuries. But what he's doing, and this is a real powerful thing to have in a team. The energy and the catalyst he gives players on the pitch for the moments that he's doing. He is huge. He has loads and loads of moments in a game, the high value ones, those four, five, six plays that he does in a game. They change the momentum for his players around him. He is a momentum changer. Much the same, like there's plenty of players down through the years you've had that, but that's hugely valuable in a Lions tour. Like we saw, whoever was for the Springboks come through when he flattened Owen Farrell behind the line. Mm. Like that's so powerful for your pack when you see that they can now march forward 10 yards and you're dominating the defensive line. If you can have that on the other side and you've got Robbie Henshaw coming through, making hits, making reads in behind the gain line, carrying not into people but around people or through gaps that he's so good at, that little subtle change of angle, a little bit like Jack Conan, that change of angle, attack a space, a soft shoulder, that's so much more valuable it's such a high currency at the moment that if you can get over the gain line by not running into people, the quick ball you get there, something like that's what would force a Conor Murray onto the ball, and that's when he's at his best.
One other thing I just wanted to ask you about this morning, Gordon, is John Cooney's comments this week about Johnny Sexton. It was quite interesting. He said, when I first started playing with Leinster, I found it quite difficult the way he kind of spoke to me. This sort of, I guess, Michael Jordan level of determination and level of communication with his teammates. I'm just interested in your take on how effective that is in a modern dressing room and how important characters like that, maybe not too many of them, but how important a few characters like that are in the modern dressing room.
Yeah, like it's really, you know, really important to have them. And I think you need like diversity, and like whether it's anywhere, you need all of them. But the key point is, and this is one of the things we would have had to try and understand in Leinster at a certain point, is you need, it's not the characters, it's just the personalities are the personalities, but what you need to be able to do is be able to get them to talk to each other and I suppose value each other's opinion and respect each other's opinions, and I think that's a really, really hard thing to achieve in a change room. And that's why every team doesn't win something, because people might say, "Oh yeah, I agree with that," but internally they don't. I think John's I always really enjoyed playing with John because he had that innate physical talent and skill, which is very, very rare. But John's a very, very determined and headstrong guy as well. It can be very easy to put the blame on the most dominant personality in the room. And like, listen, I got the dead stare off Johnny and everything my fault for, you know, probably 10 years, but you kind of, you learn the relationship, and you're going, that's a vent from, say, Johnny. Something happens in a game and he looks at me and they're going, and he's like, oh, listen, you know, I'm sure he's not actually blaming me for a moment, but that's his process, and you get used to it and you learn the personality. But if you're equally headstrong, and you start pushing back, and you have to learn how the moment was. And you know, sometimes John was very hard to get him to do what was, you know, best for the team in a moment. Because he is, if you see it for Ulster, we see it for that creative spark in him is so powerful that sometimes that overrides other people's better judgment. So that's one of the biggest challenges a coach has, is trying to marry all of those pieces together. So, you know, if you have, a creative genius, you know, like some of the stuff he does is on a level with Dupont and Vaftekirk and all these guys. When he plays, it's breathtaking. But trying to marry that with, you know, somebody of Johnny's capabilities and vision, and, you know, it's World Player of the Year. You know, that doesn't happen by chance. And I think there's not every coach in the world would be able to. I suppose align those two things.
Gordon, thanks a million. We've tweeted out the details for how people can get involved,
and
people can see it on screen there. Best of luck with it if we're not talking to you, and hopefully catch you on the other side. Thanks a million.
Take care, guys.
Cheers. Gordon Darcy there, talking all things Lions, and as I said, he's doing an 850-kilometre round Ireland cycle. It's going to take him 4 days. He's absolutely mad for doing it, and you do need to get on board and throw him a few quid for a brilliant cause with Bardstown. The details up on the screen, the details on our social channels, and the details up on Gordon's social channels as well. 8:10, Friday morning. We've got a packed show still to come for you right here on OTB AM. We're going to have the live crappy quiz, as always. They've tended to be a bit more crappy than usual, given the live context. We haven't had to edit out all the weird stuff. There's our GA quick picks still to come a little bit later on, and we're going to be talking football with Daniel Harris next.
OTB AM.
You're watching OTB AM. It's 12 minutes past 8, and we're delighted to have you along with us. Do keep your comments coming into us, plenty of them on YouTube and all the other platforms as well, or wherever it is you're listening or watching us this morning. We're delighted to have you along with us, and delighted to say the football writer Daniel Harris joins us on the line. Good morning, Daniel.
Hiya.
5 days after, obviously, the event, I've never known a penalty shootout reaction that's had such little focus on the shootout. How's everybody? Is there a collective cathartic movement happening over there?
Not really. I don't know. It doesn't seem, I think that most people were quite pleased with how the team did. And so I think it's also hard to argue that Italy weren't the best team in the competition also. So, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's just the people I know. Most people have kind of looked at it quite sensibly. And because what happened afterwards was what everyone knew was going to happen afterwards, as you're kind of sitting there watching the players that are going up to take the penalties and watching the players that missed the penalties, I was going to say in the back of your mind, but it's not the back of your mind, the forefront of your mind, you feel like you know what's happening. Mm. So, and what's going to happen if they miss. So it feels like the reaction to the missed penalties overtook very much discussion of the penalties. And that's even before you factor in what sounds quite chaotic experience at Wembley.
The reaction to it, I think, is going to be, as it plays out continually and as the players themselves continue to come out and obviously speak about it very eloquently, I wonder about the open nature of the conversation, Daniel, off the back of it, as to whether it, I mentioned a sort of collective catharsis maybe off the back of it, but is there a chance that it, in another way, deepens divides in that, like, it's easy for people to sort of maybe further express deeply held and at times very weird opinions about this stuff. Is there a chance that it ends up deepening divides rather than being any kind of a healing process?
I think that football is a product of the divides rather than something that necessarily inspires it. So I think that what we saw is a reflection of the divides that already exist. So it might exacerbate them in the moment, but I doubt that any new racists or anti-racists were created as a result of what happened in the penalty shootout. I think it just gives people an excuse to voice the sentiments that's already there, and let's be real, the kind of sentiments that have been legitimised by successive Tory governments. This isn't something that just happened in a vacuum. It happened because we've seen racism from David Cameron. We've seen racism from Theresa May. We've seen racism from Boris Johnson. We've seen racism from the entirety of the Tory party, more or less. There's not obviously every single individual within it, but all those people, the leaders within it, have been publicly racist more than once. And the people that voted for them and the people that remained members of that party are tacitly accepting the fact that it's acceptable. So it's not that these divides exist, then they were created and milked for political gain. And what happens on a football pitch is only going to encourage people to voice what was already there. It's not turning people who weren't racist, as I said, it's not turning people who weren't racist into racists. And it's not turning people into anti-racists either, because anyone who understands the importance of anti-racism, I'm sure, was there already. I mean, perhaps not. It would be, in some ways, like, nice isn't the right word, but it would be better if some people... It would be good if some people had seen the response to this precise thing, and football's ability to talk to everyone had opened people's eyes. But I think at this point in human history, if your eyes aren't open at this point, it's because you're closing them on purpose.
Mm. Definitely doesn't feel like a moment of, like, education or learning for a lot of people, other than, like, maybe, as I said, maybe deepening those divides. On the political side, and the reaction to it, and Gary Neville gave a great voice to it in the following day after the game, you've mentioned a litany of political leaders that have had unusual rhetoric over the last while. It might suggest that there is a kickback, a political kickback, an election kickback from that sort of stuff, Daniel, or is it just that business as usual?
We're so little time into the electoral term, and at some point we're going to get the bounce of everyone being able to go about their business again after Corona, that I don't think it's going to make a lot of difference. Mm. Because, and I think very specifically with Boris Johnson, one of the problems with getting Boris Johnson out for people that care about competent government and morality is that all this stuff was baked in from the beginning. When people voted for Boris Johnson, lots of people, not all the people, but probably most of the people, knew what Boris Johnson was, because he'd never hidden it. So when all the things happened that you know about already, well, most people already made their peace with that when they voted for him, if they even had to make peace with it in the first place. So it feels slightly different that when you have, as it is now, when you have a government that goes in and preaches morality. So the last Labour government, Tony Blair's Labour government, came in at the end of a period of sleaze. And what you'd had was, you'd had John Major talking about this back to basics campaign and good old-fashioned family values, or, well, what the Tory party can considered to be family values at the time. And then you've got MP after MP getting caught performing all sorts of adulteries and also slightly unusual sexual proclivities. And because it went together with this back to basics campaign, it became I think that was one of the main reasons it became a thing. I guess public morality was slightly different at that point as well. Like, people, like, conventions worked. So If a minister's department got into trouble, then the minister would resign. And that was kind of one of the ways that Britain's unwritten constitution was preserved, by keep people abiding by conventions. They don't do that anymore, and no one cares about them either. Like, the politicians don't care about them, and the public don't care about them, and the press don't really care about them that much either. So it's hard to see, for that reason and for the reason that all this stuff is already baked into Boris Johnson's premiership and something that people knew they were voting for in the first place, that this will necessarily have any electoral repercussion. And we're only, what, year and a half into, I was going to say, a five-year electoral term, but that's no longer the case. They got rid of the fixed term elections, or they are getting rid of one of the two. I think it's gone, of the Fixed Parliamentary Term Election Act. So it's hard to see. It's really, I mean, and I say this with an extreme amount of upset, that for all these reasons, and what sort of happened in Britain over the last probably 5 to 10 years, I think, and I heard this anecdotally from someone, and then I actually saw some data from The Economist about it, is what's happened is you had in what they used to call the Red Wall, where people, like working class people who were, whose parents had been miners or factory workers mainly, or whatever, that kind of thing, voted Labour without even thinking about it. Mm. Then Brexit created this big fissure, because it sort of Labour really struggled to start to keep together its electoral coalition of people who may have been, who may or may not have been socially conservative, but were, whose parents were Labour. But I think the big fissure has come because the children of those working people don't consider themselves to be working class. They're earning enough money in office jobs and that kind of thing to afford a house, to afford a car or two, to afford a few holidays. So although the Tory government despise those people, they don't see it like that. And they see their lives as quite going quite well. So when you're trying to campaign for change or devise a political narrative that will talk about the need for change, if you're people who don't really see the need for change and they see themselves as people for whom the system is working, then it's hard to convince those people not to vote for what perpetuates the system that they know to be working. And that is a problem, and it's looking at the moment like an intractable problem of the English left, because if you consider the fact that post-war, James Callaghan won the election for Labour, but the only other person to win those elections was Tony Blair. And Tony Blair won election in a very, very specific set of circumstances. He had the end, he won in 1997, and he'd had 18 years of Tory rule, so that's one. Then the other thing is the Tory party was tearing itself apart over Europe, two. Three, that back to basics campaign and sleaze that I talked about, four, a massive recession, five, and a leader of, whatever else you say about Tony Blair, and I'm not legitimising his position on Iraq or any of the rest of it, you've got a leader of undeniable charisma. And all of those things needed to coalesce for Labour to win an election. And doesn't look like those things are coalescing again, which makes it a massive problem, which means that the future of this country is, on the one hand, we can see that the racist right is losing the demographic battle. And we see it in America as well, but we're a bit further away from than America are from that demographic battle being the single deciding factor of an election. So we can all look at this football team and see how they represent the true makeup of the UK, but it's not going to be reflected in the ballot box quite yet, I don't think.
Yeah, it'll be a little while, obviously, before that happens.
State of affairs.
Yeah, it's been quite the week. We wanted to get you on to talk Manchester United as well. Daniel, are you enjoying this beautiful distraction of saying that the team viewer jersey is crap and I wonder how Jadon Sancho is going to fit on the right hand side? Are you ready for this, basically, is what I'm saying?
What I most enjoyed was there was the poet of Manchester, David Scott, when he saw there was a picture of Donny van de Beek in the team viewer t-shirt and he said, why has he got his name on the front of the shirt? it's actually, as far as shirts go, I'm 42, find it quite hard to get that excited about football shirts, or at least the ones I don't like. I quite like this shirt. It's really hard to see from the photos if it's the correct shade of red, but white sleeves are nice. So I think as far as United go, it's an interesting situation for them because they look like they might get the signings that will remove the excuses. And so if they get Sancho, it looks like Varane's going to happen. If they get a midfield player as well, then they are in a position to actually do something this season. And they'll be a little bit short at the beginning of the season, as I imagine a lot of teams will. I'm not sure who's going to make the first few games. Obviously, Marcus Rashford isn't, which I think is a good thing because if you imagine when he comes back, when he's not been fit for 2 years, when he comes back and he's sorted out his shoulder, he's sorted out his ankle, he's had a physical rest, he's had a mental rest, and he's aggravated about what happened in the Euros, then you're going to see a beast, I think. And he's also going to have to win his place in the team because Jadon Sancho and Mason Greenwood are more than able deputies or players that could take his place away from him. So I think for United, what they've got, and as a United supporter, what I really wanted was I wanted them to have a good start, a start where you felt like they could get on a roll. Because often, it's not always the case, but often when a team is trying to challenge for the title and they haven't for a bit, we saw it with United when they hadn't got anywhere near the league really in 04, 05, 06, and 05, 06. They started off with, I think, Fulham at home and Charlton away in 06, 07. They smashed them both. And then you start to get some momentum. I remember it happening with Liverpool as well. They had quite a friendly start in 08, 09, and they wound up producing a title challenge that no one really foresaw. So I think that United are definitely definitely going to be stronger than they were last season. And where I think I'd hope that Jadon Sancho would make the difference is I can't remember exactly what the stats were, but I think United may have won only 9 home league games last season. And that's where the league was lost. Mm. And I think that having Jadon Sancho able to stretch the pitch on the right, able to attack defences, another playmaker, or just giving you another option off the bench, whether he's the one on the bench or one of the other wide players is on the bench, will make quite a big difference in those games. The question is whether United can continue winning as many away games as they did, because that looked more like a freak. So maybe it will just balance out. They'll win a few more home games, a few fewer away games. That wouldn't be enough for the title, but if they get Varane and then they get that midfield player, then they're really in with a chance, in theory.
On Varane and on the possibility of Kieran Trippier, how confident and how potentially satisfied are you about those two moves?
I think Varane's going to happen. I tweeted about it quite a long time ago now, when just what I had heard made me think that that was a deal that was going to be done, because ultimately Real Madrid needed to sell, United wanted to buy him, and he wasn't going to be that expensive, and the player wanted to leave. So those three things coalesced, and you would think that's likely to happen. Trippier, I'm not sure about. I mean, I saw Neil Custis from The Sun said, using the great fabled transfer double sweep headline, talked about that both those deals were close to completion. Neil Custis has been on the Manchester beat for a long time. He's not making it up. Doesn't mean it'll happen, because obviously sometimes you get misinformed and lots of things have to happen sometimes before a transfer. But yeah, I think Trippier would be a good deal for United in theory. He'd be a good deal for United because he'd give them a more attacking option instead of Aaron Wan-Bissaka, which is good. He can cover on both sides, which actually means you can start thinking about selling Diogo Dalo, Brandon Williams, maybe even Alex Telles, because you've got Trippier who can give you cover. And also, he's a good age in that he's at his physical peak now. He knows he is the player that he is. He understands how to defend. He understands the game. He understands his body. And United have got Ethan Laird behind him. So what that would be is you give Trippier, say, a three to four year contract. Ethan Laird goes out on loan this season. He has a Premier League loan next season. And then as Trippier's coming to the end of his contract, you've got Ethan Laird, who looks like he might go on to be better than both him and Wan-Bissaka. So in that aspect, it's a really good buy. It's less of a good buy, I guess, if, because obviously you don't want that attacking option going forward down the right and down the left. And so Luke Shaw is a slightly less good option if it means because of it you can't buy a midfield player. And I wouldn't be diverting, let's say, 20 million quid towards Kieran Trippier if I stopped United from buying the midfield player that they need. But if they were able to buy Varane, Trippier and Sancho with the budget, they ought really to be able to raise what they need for a midfield player with sales, because Brandon Williams might go, Dalot might go, as I mentioned, Jesse Lingard might go. I think they'd probably sell Anthony Martial if they got a good offer for him as well. So at that point, you start to be adding together the money, maybe also the goalkeeper, and then you should have enough for the midfield player too.
If they do get both of those players, what does that United defence look like?
I think it depends. I think what you'd see is you'd see Varane and Maguire start almost every game. Lindelof is a really good number three. You might then see Eric Bailly leave, which I think would be fair enough for all parties. He's had enough chances and he's not stayed fit. But also, when he has stayed fit, he also hasn't been reliable enough. I think Axel Tuanzebe might take a Premier League loan for him, and then see how that were to go. If he were to get a Premier League loan, and if he were to go and do well, then he put himself in with a good chance of being the third choice. And then in, say, 2 years, when Varane's 30, 31, then you might start thinking about integrating him as a first choice. But if someone said, here's £30 million for Tuanzebe, I think they'd probably take that as well. But you'd see, I think what you'd see is Varane and Maguire start almost every game. Then Luke Shaw would start most of the games. And then on the right, if they were to get Trippier, you'd see Wan-Bissaka probably start all the big away games, a lot of the big home games, and then the games that United were struggling to win last season. So if I'm right, they won 9 out of 18 home games. The other 9, for those kind of games that United weren't winning, you'd be seeing Trippier start. And then the rest of it would just kind of depend on the precise opponent or on who was injured. But yeah, I still think you'd see pretty similar back four to last season, except Wan-Bissaka and Trippier would do something of a job share. I'm talking nonsense at this point. It wouldn't be the same at all, because Varane would be replacing Lindelof. You know what I mean?
Yeah. job shares. It's what's listened. It's the front of the jersey. It's the club philosophy now. It's very far out, and there's plenty of moving parts. There's Chelsea spending. There's possibly Kane to City, and possibly not. So loads of moving parts. But given those couple of moves and what's happening elsewhere, what's your levels of confidence about United's ability to challenge when we eventually get back into it in about 4 weeks?
I would never think too much about what the other teams are going to do. It's what United do and whether I think they can get enough points to win the title. I think that if they don't get a midfield player, they are capable of still winning the title because, I mean, we've seen it done before with Fergie teams towards the end where he basically had a good attack and a good defence and not enough in midfield. And it wasn't good enough for the Champions League, but it was good enough to win the Premier League. Obviously, that team had Fergie, but so it's a little bit different. But this team, assuming Varane arrives, there's going to be a good defence and there's going to be loads of goals. That is enough to win the Premier League. Whether there's quite enough to control enough games, you're with the team as it is, without a midfield player, you're sort of taking a risk in the big games that the defenders will defend well and the forwards will find you a goal. Because let's say the midfield is, for argument's sake, McTominay, Pogba and Bruno, or even in the big games, McTominay, Fred and Bruno, there probably isn't enough in there to either control the game or set a tempo of a game. And so when that's the case, you would think that you wouldn't get quite enough big game points to win the league or to win Champions League. But with the defence that United look like they're going to have and the attackers they're going to have, there's more than enough to win every game. So it is possible. But with the right midfield player, whether I don't think it'll be Declan Rice. I can't imagine United are going to buy Varane and Sancho and maybe Trippier and have enough money then to spend it on Rice. But I've said this a lot, that I'm absolutely certain that I'm sure United, one of the reasons Rice is enticing is because he plays in England. We've seen a lot of him. He's the right kind of character. You know exactly what you're going to get. I'm absolutely certain there's a better player than Rice that you could get for half, but whether you would choose to pursue that. But I think that if United do get a midfield player at this point, that's what it would have to be. And then there's probably more risk, but perhaps more potential upside as well, whether it's Camavinga or someone else, that you might even get a better player than Rice. So if United were to get a midfield player and it were to be the right midfield player, then there's absolutely no excuses. They'd have everything that they need to win the title. And then whether they do or they don't will either be because Ole hasn't managed them well enough or the players haven't played well enough or combination of both. But if they were to get that player, then they would have a real hit at the title, I think. But the bar's going to be high. I mean, if City have the most money, the best or the second best manager, and they sign Harry Kane, then that's a big problem for everyone. And if United were to not win the title from there, then, you know, it may be just because other teams had more of everything. So they are set for a good season, but I think a good start, I mean, it sounds like a ludicrous thing to say, of course a good start is important, but a good start is important. And they haven't had that the last 2 years and they ended up finishing second. But and you actually saw it with Pochettino. A couple of times Pochettino went for the title, the one against Chelsea and the one against Leicester and the one against Chelsea. Spurs were brilliant from about November, December, wherever it was, but they lost the title because they didn't start well enough. And I think that this, in some ways, is what Jose Mourinho brought to the English game. That Fergie always used to say, we don't start get going until after Christmas in the new year, like it was some lovable quirk, taking off half the year. But then Mourinho turned up, and I think Mourinho's first game as manager of Chelsea was United at home. They won 1-0. The penalty, maybe, against a terrible United team because United were kind of in between teams and they had injuries. But anyway, they won that first game against United 1-0. And from then on, you could not take half the season off and win the Premier League title. And that's what United will need to do. They need to start properly and they need to keep at it because it will be probably quite a lot of points winning the league this season because City will get a lot of points because they've settled this new team and they might sign Harry Kane. Liverpool are going to be much better again. Chelsea are going to sign a striker, at least one striker. And if they get a good striker, that's going to make a phenomenal amount of difference. They're going to have all year of Tuchel and a pre-season with Tuchel. So it's going to be hard. It's going to be tough. And my one worry about this Premier League season is that we end up seeing too many points at the top end again. We don't want to see teams winning the league with 95 plus points. We want sort of 85 to 90-ish because you want the teams below that to be putting on a challenge on a weekly basis. So hopefully that's what we're going to see. But yeah, it may well be that the teams at the top end up getting a silly amount of points again.
Yeah, I suspect you wouldn't mind if it was United, mind you, but...
well, no, look, I want United to win the league, but I'm not... Number one, if you ask me which league titles as a United supporter I've enjoyed more, it's quite an easy answer, really. Like 93, 96, 99, 03, 07 and 13. And what they have in common, they all have other features in common as well. Obviously, 13 was the last year of Fergie and they won it early. So the run-in was just a just successive parties after parties, and it was a lot of fun. But the thing that all those years have in common is it comes after the year you've lost the title. And I think that's important, that you don't want a team winning all the time, because it's not entertaining, it's not enjoyable, there's no sense of jeopardy.
Yeah.
You want it to be close, you want to win tight title races. You want teams not to win the same title every year. You want teams not to win every week. And similarly, like, I can sit here and say, as I sometimes do, that Roman Abramovich should never have been allowed near English football. Sheikh Mohammed should never have been allowed anywhere near English football. But if they hadn't have been allowed near English football, could United have won basically every league title from 2007 to 2013? Like, that's possible, and we don't want that either. And so there's a difference between wanting your team to win and wanting it to mean something when your team wins. And the way it means something when your team wins is by jeopardy and competition. So United running away with the league title is obviously sounds like a good thing in theory, but it's not something definitely that you want to see on a regular.
No. All right, Daniel, thanks a million.
All right, guys. See you again. Have a good day, everyone. Have a good weekend.
Cheers. Thank you. Daniel Harris, as always, talking to United England. Lots more as well. Besides, we have loads to come. 8:36. It's Friday morning, episode 10 of the Football Pod with Paddy and Andy, our Gaelic football podcast, with the 7-time All-Ireland winner, Paddy Andrews, and my own legend, Andy Moran, is available right now. You can get it on the OTB Sports app, the OTB stream, or just search the Football Pod with Paddy and Andy. Here are the lads along with Tommy. And what sort of role Michael Murphy is going to play for Donegal this weekend?
They get Murphy. Murphy will be on the pitch on Sunday. By hook or by crook, he'll be on the pitch. Whether it be right.
You think?
Look.
20, it's what do you think? Give me a number. How long do you think he'll get?
I think they'll probably start him, to be honest. Really? They'll do whatever they can to get him on the pitch. Because this is essential. This is the season on the line. If you look at this game for Duher and Logan, for Tyrone, and for Declan Bonner, after last year's shambles of losing to Cavan in the Ulster final, this makes or breaks both their seasons. If Tyrone win, I think they'll win the Ulster Championship to get to an All-Ireland semi-final. And that's a really, really positive first year for Logan and Duher. On the flip side, if Donegal win, I think they win the Ulster Championship, they get to an All-Ireland semi, and they play a big game against Kerry. That's Declan Bonner's progress. But if one of them loses, whoever loses on Sunday, it's like out of the Ulster semi-final, season's over. That is a bad year.
I would disagree with that, Paddy. I would actually agree with what you're saying in terms of the importance of the game, in terms of Declan Bonner's season and Duher's season. And to be honest, word for word, I would say the exact same thing to you. It's catastrophic for Donegal and Declan Bonner and Stephen Rutherford and them guys if they lose.
Yeah.
For Duher, it's definitely the first season. But with Murphy, Donegal have to have one eye still. Their aim cannot be just to win an Ulster title. And if they played Murphy the next day, he's gone. There's no way. I think he'll do really well to play 2025. I think that'll be his influence on the game. I think Tyrone will target him. I do think Derry, when he came on, were tired and a tiny bit got spooked by Murphy and the left. I'd say it's driving Rory Gallagher mental, because even for Niall O'Donnell's point, Conor Glass is stepping a step back instead of a step in, a step forward, because he's thinking about Murphy behind him instead of thinking about Niall O'Donnell. So those little things like that changed. But Murphy, for me, is the catalyst for everything good, Donegal. And I don't think he'll start against Tyrone.
Yeah, the Football Pod with Paddy, Andy and Tommy on Wednesdays. We wear black, I think, is the memo that was put around before that. Adrian pointing out there that they're morphing into one another. Tommy Rooney is going to be with us in just a moment. Will O'Callaghan will be with us in just a moment, because it is time for our quick picks.
some of these critics, these pundits.
I absolutely adore them lads. I have unbelievable time for them, but they're a great bunch, but it's not acceptable.
They like to play the hard man when they're on it. It's not very pleasant when you're trying to manage a team. All you're looking for is a bit of civility and a bit of decency, but they just dismiss you like you know, you have nothing to do with the bloody occasion.
The runaway train of Adrian Barry. We are running after the runaway train of Adrian Barry. We are looking at his scores that he's put up over the last couple of weeks. We have changed the rules to try and rein him in a little bit. Let's have a look at how last week went, or how the table now looks as a result of last week. Adrian still in the lead on 25 points. Will on 23 points. I'm in third on 22 points. Tommy way down to the bottom on 21 points. After tipping Cavan to beat Tyrone last week, he overthought it. He sent an email at midnight on a Thursday night. Tommy, never send emails at midnight on a Thursday night. It is the rule, but we are going to change things up this week. You get your 1 point for a correct prediction, picking the correct team. You get 2 additional points if you get the margin of victory bang on. And if you don't get that, we'll give 1 point to the person who comes closest to the exact scoreline, unless everybody's picked the wrong team. We're not going to give people an extra point for getting the team wrong. So those are the new rules. Adrian, we're coming for you.
Rancor. There's going to be a lot of rancor.
There certainly will. Speaking of, let's get into our first set of predictions this morning. We are looking at the provincial semi-finals here in Ulster. And it is Tyrone against Donegal, probably the standout fixture this Sunday. And then tomorrow it is Armagh versus Monaghan. So Tyrone against Donegal. We are all going for Donegal wins. Will, you've gone for Donegal win by a point. I'm going for the exact same thing. Adrian and Tommy both going for a 2 point win. Tommy, I might throw this one out to you. First of all, any concern that you're going to get this one badly wrong?
An email at midnight that I was changing my pick to Tyrone. Close. It's going to be really, really, really close this game. I don't think Murphy will start. I think he'll come on. I just think that Donegal have had their wake-up call again. They were very lax against Derry. They were so lucky they got through. And I just don't think Tyrone are ready yet to take them down.
Will?
Yeah, I suppose not too different to that. Like, Donegal found answers when they needed them last week. Like, Derry put in an incredible, particularly first half performance, and then Donegal just about reeled them in for the scores at the end. And like, what a finish by McBrearty for that winning point. And like, even though Michael Murphy was probably at what 50-60% last week, he still came in and added a bit of stability when he was able to come off the bench. And I think the time that he comes on this weekend will determine what position they're in the game. For me, this is one of the games of the weekend, but yeah, I just kind of fancy Donegal to maybe get over by a point or two in the end, but it's going to be properly tight. I mean, the Ulster Football Championship is where it's at for excitement this summer, it seems.
Adrian, are you looking at the Derry war that Donegal found themselves in last week as a positive or a negative for Donegal?
I mean, I think it's a negative, but I'm sort of hoping and assuming that they're going to put it all behind them. Like, are we going to get the Derry Donegal? Are we going to get the Down Donegal? And this game has definitely got the possibility to make all of us look like mugs next week, because there is a possibility that Tyrone come very good in that game. I think that Donegal will be stung as well, and they'll probably use the Martin McHugh comments at halftime at the BBC about a lot of these players not being worthy of the Donegal jersey. That might be a bit of fire for the belly. Everybody needs a call. Derek McGrath is writing about the hurling in the Examiner this morning, and Donegal probably have that now. But yeah, I mean, all of our predictions, it'll be tight.
Yeah, you're not going as tight as we are though on Armagh against Monaghan, as we've seen on screen there just a moment ago. I'm going for Monaghan by a point. You're going for Monaghan by 3 points. Tommy and Will both going for Armagh by 2. Why have you gone for Monaghan by 3 points, Adrian?
We just don't know where Armagh are at, I suppose, is the point. And again, it's definitely got this one 100%. Like, a lot of the games we were looking at last week were pretty clear calls. But again, this one is very 50-50. I think that if any team is going to win it by a few points, it's probably going to be Monaghan. But we just don't know what that Armagh side are. They
why don't we know where Armagh are at, given they've managed to survive in Division 1 and they've won by 13 points in their first game in the Ulster Championship?
I'm right to say they haven't been in an Ulster final since 2008.
This is a new Armagh.
That's very true. And defensively, they look really sound. They look like an entirely different proposition. They're flooding forward in a way that we haven't seen Armagh teams do for quite some time. I wouldn't be with any huge degree of confidence. I wouldn't put my house on Monaghan here, but I think if any team is going to win it by a few points, it might be them. And again, like, a lot of pressure on them to come good on the side of the draw that might be seen as the easy side of it. But we know they've come up short, obviously, when they were supposed to get the job done as recently as last year.
We come back to that Donegal game every week here on Quick Picks whenever we're talking about Armagh. I think that's spooked a lot of people. It hasn't spooked you, Tommy. You think Armagh are going to take that step into an Ulster final?
Yeah, I've been backing Armagh for a couple of years now. I don't agree with the term that they're playing Harlem Globetrotters football. Kieran McKeever would argue with you that they're actually more defensive than they've ever been. They're getting more players behind the ball, but they're just breaking really quickly in transition. I love their forwards. I think they're brilliant. I'd argue with Adrian that the form line would say that Armagh beat Monaghan by 4 points 6 weeks ago, a little more maybe, in the league. And the league was very important this year. Those teams took those games very seriously. What I would say is that Monaghan, they're a horribly sticky team. Like, they've got McManus and McCarron who can do anything on any given day. It's hard to back against Monaghan, but I just think that the arc of the two teams are going different directions. I think Armagh on the way up, Monaghan on the way down, and we're going to see it this weekend. Armagh by 3 for me.
Will, why are you saying that this is going to happen for Armagh? I'm on the Monaghan camp, by the way. I think that the league game is really important. I think this is going to be the football game of the weekend. But I just think that Monaghan's know-how in certain areas is actually going to be important. I actually do think that the recent history of Armagh, even though I questioned you on it there a moment ago, Adrian, is going to be important. So I think these moments take a massive leap forward from a team, or they require a massive leap forward from a team. And Will, you obviously see it happening from Armagh's perspective this weekend.
Yeah, look, the concern will be the old adage, league is league, championship is championship, even when they've come very close one after another this year. Like a month ago, I was very impressed with the way that Armagh beat Monaghan when Monaghan had quite a bit of the ball, but Armagh were very good at turning it around on the counter-attack. I'm hoping that lightning will strike twice. I think that Armagh are a very difficult team to break down. I think their first-round win in Ulster will have been a huge confidence builder a couple of weeks ago. They've had time to get ready for this game against Monaghan too. And I think we're going to see a breakthrough in Kieran McGeaney's side. They're going to get back into an Ulster final for the first time in over a decade. But it is like a really tough one to call. Part of me, I will admit, went down the line of, I reckon Adrian Barry is probably going to go for Monaghan here, and I need a point of difference to try and get a point back as well. So I just edged towards Armagh on that one. I do think that Armagh are going to be able to just stop and eke out a close one against Monaghan this weekend.
Let's move to Leinster. Two games that are happening in Leinster this weekend. I mean, we're looking at Meath Dublin here, first of all. Adrian's going for Dublin by 6. I'm going for Dublin by 12. Tommy's going for Dublin by 5. Will is going for Dublin by 11. So there are two schools of thought here. One is that Dublin will be fine and that they will win by a big margin. And there's a school of thought that the rivalry is back and that it will be a couple of kicks of a ball in it. So Tommy, you believe that Meath could win this weekend if you're suggesting that they're only going to lose by 5, I suspect.
Publicly, professionally, I've learned my lesson. I think that Meath will put on a good performance. I think that they will get a goal or two early on. I think they'll make a game of it. And I think it'll be a match for sure for 50, 60 minutes. Who knows what'll happen after that? I reckon Dublin are going to pull away and they're going to have just too much. They are, remember, 6th time in a row at Ireland winners here. Like, they have beaten Meath six of the last times they've met in Leinster. Yeah, Dublin by 5 for me, but it's going to be a good performance from Meath.
Will, you're not having that. You're in my camp that Dublin are going to rack up a big win.
Yeah, look, I think any sense of complacency or a slow start that may have been there from Dublin will probably be out of them after the way they played against Wexford. I would imagine there was a lot of kind of introspection after the way that they played in Wexford Park a couple of weeks ago, and they'll be ready now that they get back to Croke Park to open up again. Notwithstanding, there'd be a few concerns about Dublin's injuries defensively, where Meath could potentially get a score against them, but I think no matter what Meath bring on Sunday afternoon, the Dubs are going to have at least 10 points to spare against them. I think this time last year, we talked about a Leinster final and potentially Meath scoring goals, and Dublin went out and annihilated them. They've pretty much hammered everyone over the last couple of years, and I think that the Wexford performance was a one-off, and we get to see Dublin back to their best this weekend.
Well, the Dubs have 26 players though, Will. That's the thing.
I know.
There's a cool going on there.
Look, the panel is more stretched than it was previously, but still, I still think the Dublin are a cut above everyone else in the country. And as much, Tommy, as I would love Meath to be running that game down with 2 or 3 minutes to go, I think a bit like you said, once we get to the hour mark, I think Dublin will be in control and they'll walk this out by 10 points or more.
The big one, Kildare versus Westmeath. I'm going for Kildare by 5. Will is going for Kildare by 3. Tommy's going for Kildare by 4. Adrian, Barry, going for Westmeath by 3 points. Give us your logic, Adrian.
Lads, you're disgracing yourselves by putting that big of a margin on it from the Kildare point of view. And Owen, you have, you would have thought that your greatest shame of the summer so far, calling Laois to beat Westmead the other week, you would have sort of realised by now that it's a fool's game to
just back Kerry managers.
Westmead team. That is totally fair enough. I think look at Westmead based on the fact that I think they're a slightly different Westmead, not entirely revolutionised, but a slightly different Westmead than we've seen before. They're racking up good scores, 3-10-20 against Laois. They scored well, obviously, against Cork in the final. They scored well against Mayo, even though they came out the wrong side of it during the league, and a couple of decent scores as well besides that. Kildare, look at, well, like, I don't know on what basis people consider Kildare. I've often made the point that obviously Westmead and Dublin have had between them Leinster sewn up over the last 15 years. I think that'll continue after this weekend. They'll meet again in the Leinster final. I think that if Westmead can keep Neil Flynn to 4 or 5 points, then I think that's the winner of it. In terms of any league form, you can't read anything into Kildare getting promoted from the group they were in, and I think you can take a lot from Westmeath performing as well as they did in, against like better opposition. So yeah, it's all pointing to Westmeath for me, lads.
Right, okay, so there's logic to match the really emotional elements here. We must move on to the hurling here, because there are some crackers this weekend, to say the least. It is a huge weekend. So we're going to start with the provincial finals here. Tip versus Limerick. We are all picking Limerick in this one. Adrian going for 4, I'm going for 6, Tommy's going for 2, Will's going for 4, and then Dublin versus Kilkenny. We're all going for the favourites here as well. Kilkenny, Adrian and myself going for a 6-point margin, Will going for a 5-point margin, Tommy going for a 7-point margin. Will O'Callaghan, which of these two should we be most conscious of an upset in?
I'm nearly more conscious of an upset between Dublin and Kilkenny, because Dublin made us all look like mugs a few weeks ago when it seemed that Galway were going to saunter through when they met in the Leinster Championship, and Dublin went out that day and they shook Galway down very impressively, particularly in the second half. But then I don't think Kilkenny will perform in the same way that Galway did. Like, I was so impressed by Kilkenny in extra time against Wexford a couple of weeks ago when they needed to get the job done, particularly when they were a man down after Murphy got the sin bin. And then even at that point in the game, Kilkenny were able to kick on. They look really fit and sharp this season. And slowly but surely, because we've been looking at, you know, Brian Cody's teams and wondering, is he going to go for another year? He's just sprinkled in 2 or 3 young players each season over the last couple of years. It's been an evolution as opposed to a revolution from Kilkenny. But Dublin hurled really well against Kilkenny in the Championship over the last couple of years. Kilkenny needed a late flurry to get past them last time out. So I think that game in theory will be a little bit closer maybe even than the game that's being played in Munster. But I think Kilkenny will have the firepower in the end to come out by a few points. Limerick have had Tipperary's number. So from that point of view, I'm expecting Limerick to do exactly the same thing again. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if Tipperary are the worst matchup for Limerick this summer. I think they're more likely to have problems against a team who are more physical based. And, you know, Tipperary were okay against Clare, but not exactly brilliant. So it's hard to back against the Kings of the last 3 or 4 years in Limerick to actually knock them through in that one. So I think Dublin are going to give Kilkenny a bit of a fright, but I expect Limerick to lift the new Mackey Cup of the weekend.
We need to talk about the big hurling game of the weekend, in fairness, which is Clare-Wexford. No safety net anymore for these two teams. We'll get to that in just a moment, but just to run through some of the predicted margins of victory in the other two, Kerry against Westmeath there in the Joe McDonagh Cup final. You boys all tipping Westmeath. Yeah, I see. I'm tipping Kerry by 2.
Well, you talk about like the heart leading the head. I mean, it's crazy stuff.
I mean, last year's finalists, they've been there, done well. They didn't do that. They got beaten in the final last year.
been beaten.
But they almost done that, and I think they will do that this weekend. And I think they will be bringing an All Ireland title back home to Kerry earlier than advertised. Laois against Waterford.
They lost to Carlow in the league, by the way, Kerry. Just to.
Big margins of victory there. No Kerry hurling slander here on this show this morning. Just coincidentally, myself, Tommy, Adrian, we're all going for Waterford by 12. Will, you think this is going to be a bit tighter? Is this certain sort of Midlands bias? A 7-point win for Waterford is what you're saying. We just want to talk about Clare against Wexford here. The room is split a little bit. I'm going for a Clare win by 4 points. Tommy, you're going for 3. Adrian, you're going for 1. But Will is going for 2. Tommy, you've, embedded yourself so much into Clare society at this point, you know that this is going to be a win rather than just guessing, right?
100%. Yeah, and I think everybody in Clare thinks that as well, that there's no doubt at all that David Fitzgerald and Wexford could spring a surprise even this weekend. I know they're heavy underdogs. No, look, I think about this game, the struggle is, where does the form lie? Like, Clare played very well against Tipperary, but did Tipperary underperform? Wexford played very well against Kilkenny. I know we're all tipping Kilkenny this weekend against Dublin, but you know, I'm banking on Tipperary being stronger than Kilkenny this year, and by that virtue, Clare in a better place than Wexford are, and Tony Kelly.
Yeah,
I think that's a pretty significant factor, Adrian.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the league meeting, Clare were stiffed a bit by Wexford or whatever much you can read into that, but they were 8 or 9 points up or something to that degree late on in the game, a little bit more concentration. Championship, Tony Kelly. I think that also The how close they ran Kilkenny last weekend, was it last weekend, whenever it was, for Wexford might be as good as it gets for them. Like, the way they fell apart so badly in the end might actually be quite damaging to them.
And sorry, finally then, Adrian, give us the reasons why you think a team who finished up with a scoring difference of -106 in the National Hurling League are going to be All-Ireland champions tomorrow in Croke Park.
Westmeath,
yes.
With their Division 1 team on, and yes, there was the two Westmeath teams ran in parallel across Hurling and football, in that results weren't going to go their way, but they always knew that was going to be the case anyway. There was never, I don't think, any idea that they were ever going to get anything from any of those games. But I think that, like, so it's on that basis that you leave the league going, well, we knew that was going to happen, we've had 4 or 5 good tests against like far superior opposition, and Kerry are coming in having been beaten by Carlow. So it's a bit of a no-brainer for me. I should say, by the way, on the I failed to mention it on the football, the Kildare-Westmeath football side of it, Kildare have beaten nobody of any worth in Leinster since they beat Tommy Shower in 2017. So, like,
I'll be honest.
Anybody, huh?
I'll be honest. I only went for Kildare for the reason that I knew you'd go for Westmeath and I have to try and catch it. That's genuinely the only reason.
Like, yeah, but
I really struggle to back Kildare. Yeah. I know last week I told the people of Tyrone I have nothing against them, like I do with the people of Cork, but like Kildare, I just can't back Kildare. Like, they're just such a hard team. Westmeath love pain. Going up against Dublin and getting smashed in the Leinster final, so I think that's the way it's going
to
happen.
Well, all I can say is apologies to everyone at home. We have lied to you this morning. Tommy doesn't believe that Kildare are going to win, but he said it anyway. It's a disappointing...
I'm trying to catch up on the table.
Disappointing revelation.
He's straddling both horses now, of course, on as well as the other thing.
It's cynical. This has been, thank you, Will and Tommy, this week's Quick Picks.
I absolutely adore them lads. I have unbelievable time for them, but they're a great bunch, but it's not acceptable.
All right, it's 5 to 9. You're watching OTB AM, and we are brought to you by Gillette. Good mornings. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. We've had lots of comments coming into us this morning, whether it was the rugby or the football and everything else beside, and including a great shout for sponsor of our next item from Andrew Geraghty. Good morning to Andrew, who's wondering if Vernacci could jump on board and sponsor the crappy quiz. For anybody who was watching last week, that is very good show indeed. Keep your comments coming into us. But before all of that, John Duggan, good morning to you.
Adrian and Owen, how are we all doing?
Good, thank you. And I think we need to start with we were chatting a little bit earlier on about the front page of a lot of the newspapers today. It's not, for anybody who needs to do a double take there, it's not in fact Brian O'Driscoll, but the Bryson DeChambeau stuff is just weird, John.
Yeah, it's odd for someone to come out and have a go at an equipment manufacturer in the way he did, to say that his driver sucked and that was the reason why he didn't play so well yesterday, and then to be called on that by the manufacturer, and then to apologise on Instagram, say it was very unprofessional. And it just strikes me as somebody that needs to maybe consider what they say before they say it. The wider thing for me about Bryson DeChambeau, whatever about his petulance, is that I don't think he plays the game in a very sensible way. I know he won a US Open. I know he hits it very far and is trying to revolutionise the way the game is played by getting as far up the fairway as he can to make it easier to make birdies and eagles and albatrosses and all those kind of things. But golf at a major level requires finesse. And that's why Jack Nicklaus won 18 majors. That's why Tiger won 15. Sometimes length isn't always the be-all and end-all, especially with the rough around Royal St. George's. So I think we saw that in the final round of the US Open, that the wheels came off the train there, and whether it was slips off the tee, but ultimately his course management was poor. And I think that he will lose more tournaments at this level than he will win with poor course management. And that's what we're seeing here. And we're seeing then the explosion And Bryson DeChambeau and Brooks Koepka, all these lads have been in the news too much, in my view. They need to get out of the news and start playing some golf and shut up, effectively.
Yeah, I was watching some of the coverage last night, and Laura Davies was asked, she was given five players, Westhuizen, Spieth, Morikawa, there was a couple of more, maybe Tommy Fleetwood was in there as well, all generally, obviously, Westhuizen leading, and then all sort of within three or four of the lead. And she was asked, would she take that bunch or would she take the field? And she was saying she'd take the field. What's your sense of like reading into things after day one?
Well, Morikawa was the only person who's made a move so far early on the second day, so he's got to 400 par, two shots off the pace. And Colin Morikawa, a USPGA champion, hasn't much experience at the Open, but he's the best iron player in the game, best approach player in the game. Look, I think you have to look at the two at the top, Westhuizen and Spieth. Westhuizen nearly won both the USPGA and the US Open. He's the Irishman, Colin Byrne on the bag. Westhuizen has one of the most beautiful swings in the game. He's won the Open before at St. Andrews back in 2010. He's been second famously in all four majors. But the thing that's been different for him this season is his putting. His putting is much more improved. And we saw that he very nearly beat Mickelson, he very nearly beat Rahm, and he didn't. So Westhuizen is a very solid favourite. But Spieth was 82nd in the world at the end of last year. Remember, he was number one back in 2015 when he won the first two majors of the year, the Masters and the US Open. Then he won the Open at Birkdale in 2017. He's come back to form this year. He's found something. He's not spraying the ball all around the place as he was. He's found something in his long game. And he won the Texas Open, and he's been playing consistently. And Jordan Spieth, who made six birdies yesterday, has the X factor in golf. He's the most exciting player. Forget about DeChambeau. Spieth is the most exciting player to watch because he can do these amazing things, especially with the putter. Puts like Tiger Woods. So I think Spieth likes links golf. He likes the challenge. And if he can keep the ball in the fairway with his excellent approach play, I think he's a very strong contender to win. So I'm looking at those two, and I'm looking at anybody under par. And that's what the problem is for Rory McIlroy. When you're making four bogeys, as he did yesterday, and I know the conditions were trickier for him in the afternoon, but when you're making four bogeys and Louis Westhuizen is making none, you're six shots behind, and it's very hard to catch up then over 4 days. So the problem that Rory isn't that Rory can't shoot 65 or 65 again. The problem is there's too many quality players ahead of him.
Yeah. Although if there is one player that can do it, Jeddy, it's probably him.
It is. But I still think there's too many quality players ahead of him.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the field here. Webb Simpson's a major champion. Stuart Sink is playing with the sun on the bag. Really good golf. Tommy Fleetwood, 3 under par. Sergio's there too. But Westhuizen and Spieth, they'll have to come back a bit. So what I'm fascinated to see as well, lads, is will the organisers, the ORNA, allow the course to firm up a bit more over the weekend? Because it's going to be hotter. It's quite lush at the moment. I was reading Lee Westwood talking about they're going to be watering the fairways to try and avoid bad bounces. But that will make it softer. And that will play into the hands of the leaders. So Rory does need to shoot, I would say, at least 2 to 3 under par today to be in the hunt. I would rule out the rest of the Irish players.
Yeah, not beyond them. We'll keep an eye on events over the weekend. JD, thanks a million.
All right, lads, take care.
Thanks a lot. John Duggan on the line there on the golf, and it is Westhuizen leading there by one shot, 6 under par. He's out at 3 o'clock today. Half hour before that, Jordan Spieth on 5 under. Brian Harman as well around the same time. As John mentioned, Colin Morikawa out on course. He's 1 under through a couple so far. 4 under par overall alongside Webb Simpson, Mackenzie Hughes and Dylan Fratelli, Stuart Sink there as well. And as John mentioned, Rory McIlroy, best of the Irish level par. So that's what's happening there. We've a live crappy quiz coming your way in a couple of moments' time. We're going to give you a flavour, first of all, before all of that, about what's going on across the back pages. We'll start with the Telegraph, seeing as actually we'll start with otbsports.com, and the Lions brought a knife to a gunfight. That was Tommy Bowe in conversation with Nathan on the show last night, his take on all things Lions, and plenty more of reaction to that up there as well, including some interest from serious clubs, from Ireland young gun Jamie McGrath as well, and latest in the golf, plenty more as well. Keep an eye on otbsports.com over the course of the day. Or the best way to get all of it, including this, is on the OTB Sports app. Just head along to your app store, hit download, and sign up to the notifications and all of that good stuff, and we'll send you across the best bits as they happen. Now, the Telegraph is to hand, so we'll start with that. DeChambeau is behaving like an eight-year-old. This story really is worth a read wherever you pick it up this morning. It's quite a remarkable over and back between a professional sports person and a sponsor, who you would generally think that their relationships Relations are much tighter than that. The star for you this morning, Bri Baby, the same story there. Rory Keane to build on late surge. Bo Starion and deliver from the Aviva last night. And Reds put their shirt on Pogba. That's Paul Pogba dropped the biggest hit yet, that he's staying at Manchester United as he models their brand new shirt that we were talking to Daniel Harris about a little bit earlier today. The Irish Times, Westhausen sets a straight course for glory, writes Philip Reid on the back of the Open there. Strong finish leaves McIlroy in a positive frame of mind. That's all golf on the Irish Times for you. On the Sun this morning, Real Madrid, all his £50 million bid for Real's Varane, and United close in on Atletico's Trippier. So there will be a couple of big, a double swoop, as was described, and exclusive by Neil Custis. It's exactly as Daniel described it earlier on. And they have ice in their veins. Keith Hales Stars. I mean, it's good. It's good pun stuff going on this morning in the Sun. And Bri Baby, they also run with there. Bryson DeChambeau. I mean, the Mirror are keeping it pretty simple this morning. It is what it's what it does on the tin there. Stupid. Club manufacturer takes a swing at DeChambeau's comments after he blames driver for his poor round. Gypsies are having a party after Europa win. And system is not good at all, writes Dermot Connolly. No future in the provincial championship on, says Dermot Connolly. It's reported in some of the papers this morning. And it's a good insight. Paddy Andrews was talking about it on the pod a number of weeks back. The Paddy and Andy pod, the brilliant Paddy and Andy pod. Download it now. He was talking about that very thing a number of weeks back, that it isn't that they don't care about individual matches, but as a provincial championship, the medals obviously at this stage are, they are worthless.
Like they kind of are, but at the same time, I was looking at Cluxon's record the other day, and what was the Fun Free Magic Number round answer last week? Was it 16 Leinster medals that Cluxon has?
15, 16.
It's like, an incredible tally, and like the higher that goes up, it's just,
I know, but it's monopoly money, isn't it? Like, it's not, it doesn't mean anything anymore. It doesn't matter if it's 13 or it's 18 when you're at that stage.
I think that, yes, of course, it's hard to make a case that they matter. It's very hard to make a case. But I think that in, maybe I'm just, I mean, maybe my glass is well over half full at this point. Maybe in a few decades to come, we will actually look back and say, somebody's got 16 Leinster medals. That was absurd. And it's probably a reflection of where football was at. But
here's the thing, though. When you look back over, as I'm sure you spend most of your evenings doing, like over like championships from the 1800s, right, or the 1900s, and you see teams going on runs, most of my assumption at that time is, like, of course they needed to be very good to get it done, but what the hell was everybody else up to? And you're going to look at Stephen Cluxton with his 16 Leinster championships and go, my God, it had to have been that the rest of them were brutal. In 100 years' time, they'll know that Dublin and Westmeath had it locked down for those 15 years.
Yeah, like, but I just think 16 of anything is a crazy tally for a competition that happens just once a year.
It's crazy stuff. Like, and it's not as if the solutions aren't right there in front of us in terms of how to fix it without going down that road. It's just do so at this point. Just, like, how many people always talk about, like, he was saying in his comments, oh, the traditionalists won't thank me for this. Who are they at this stage? Who are the traditionalists that are saying the Leinster Football Championship should remain? And a load more besides.
And, yeah, I think that from, like, the very brief cross-section that we did of our viewers and listeners earlier this week when we went into the championship structures, I think there was a clear leaning towards lessening the prevalence of the provincial championships at the high time of the year and moving them back to the start of the season, to your pre-season, just has to be the way to go. Like, I was of the opinion maybe a few months ago that it's great that we're seeing two half-decent proposals go to Congress and may the best proposal win. After this week, I'm kind of like, screw Proposal A. I mean, that just cannot be the reality. It just cannot be allowed to happen, and Proposal B is actually quite good. So I've gone from Proposal B being grand to being good, and Proposal A from being grand to being, that's actually a really bad idea. And it's because of these provincial championships. You just, every year, and I think, like, I mean, you had Larry McCarthy earlier in the week saying, I'm not pressing the panic button just yet. And I can kind of see why he's saying that. But at the same time, it's important that these conversations are happening now, because in a few months' time, there'll be another story, there'll be another scandal, there'll be fights in a club match or something, that we will be talking about something else. It's important that while these things are happening, that we're talking about the change now, and that people like Larry McCarthy may actually be able to talk about the change. I accept that saying that, pressing the panic button just yet, isn't, he's not saying things are right or anything like that, but I don't know, there's just enough of what we've seen over recent months to suggest that Proposal B may not actually get over the line, even though from what we've, the people we've heard from and the work we've done here, is that it clearly is the best option.
Yeah, and like any competition based in a post-COVID world based on geography just makes no sense whatsoever when all the other options are so powerful in front of them. And the idea that was Jim McGuinness saying on Sky that was he saying that the history needed to be protected.
He was making the point that the medals that those Donegal lads have might actually be diminished a little bit if the future football championship is diminished a little bit. And
yeah, but like, sorry to crash on, I think that's an outrageous comment in terms of like, you just maintain, if you're all you're looking to do is protect the history, you're not protecting the future. And I think that like, let's go at it with a blank canvas. I think that it's clear and obvious that GAA football and hurling have moved on so much over the last few years in terms of approach, preparation, tactics, the physicality, etc. Like there's a big conversation to be had there around all of that detail, but to the point that they deserve better now at this stage.
Yeah, like I do think as well, if you want to look at other sports, I think that FA Cup medals, just because the FA Cup is unimportant nowadays, it doesn't mean that we look back on FA Cup medals from the 80s and 90s and say we judge them by the same standard. I mean, people are smart enough to realise when the provincial championships meant a lot. And they're smart enough to realise that Cavan's Ulster Championship last year is important and Dublin's Leinster Championship last year is unimportant. Like, we can make that distinction. People aren't stupid. They don't need to have a competition played at a certain time or given a certain amount of exposure for it to feel important. I think people can kind of make their own mind up a little bit on that front. So I think if the provincials are worth anything, if the provincials are worth saving, they'll kind of save themselves over the next few years, will they not? If there's a new proposal, and like, sure, it will be hampered by putting itself at the front of the year, but if the Ulster Championship rivalries are as strong as we think they are, and some of the same around the rest of the country, then we might actually get some good games at the start of the year, and you'll have teams that are of a Division 1 standard maybe going in cold a little bit, and who knows, there could be a little bit of a silver lining if you're a provincial championship person coming from one of these proposals over the next little while.
Yeah, but I think they're just a decreasing population. I think that like, the people whose comfort blanket is Ulster Football Championship or the Munster Hurling Championship, you'll find comfort elsewhere. Like, it's not as if this stuff has been entirely removed. There'll be great competition. Your teams will be listen, that just makes no sense to me. The Irish Mail, we wrap up these papers. The Irish Mail: Rory rallies, McIlroy happy with recovery after bad start. Some photographs from the Aviva last night. Bowles light up the Aviva, and a big line there from Michael Clifford with a boost for Tyrone as Ronan McNamee cleared last night, which might be another feather in the cap of, and put sort of a bullet in my prediction for the weekend, and also that Shane Walsh is going to line up for Galway. He's back and he's fit, and that's pretty much, the rest of them are kind of the same in terms of particularly the Bryson DeChambeau stuff across the papers. Here's what's coming up on OTB Sports Radio over the course of the day. From 1 o'clock, it'll be some OTB Gold, James McLean in studio 2 years ago, I think, at this stage. 3 o'clock will be live Friday Night Racing. At 4, Brendan Bradley is in the hot seat for the Team 33 League of Ireland legend piece. Emmanuel Petit, the subject of OTB Gold from 6, and you'll have Off the Ball live in the radio from 7 tonight, and then Team 33 on the radio from 9. You can listen to the OTB Sports app, download it now from the App Store, or go to otbsports.com/radio if you are on your desktop. Chris Waddle.
Oh, you're kidding me!
September.
Kyle Lafferty.
Are you joking me?
Is that right?
I know! Is that right?
Anybody else?
Leash, was it?
Like, that is one of the most stupid questions.
Darius Vassell? Seriously, you all need to just stay quiet. This is getting really annoying doing this quiz.
What is going on here?
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome along to the shoutiest segment on Irish radio. It's the scintillating, it's the stupefying, it's the splendido crappy quiz. Every Friday, we pit three of Team Off the Ball up against each other in a no-holds-barred quiz of sporting factoids at the end of the week. Allow me to welcome today's contestants. Our first contestant today comes into today's quiz on the back of helping Team OTB to victory in yesterday's Sport for Business Super Quiz Final. He helped see off the challenge of RTE Sport in the most vicious media face-off since Ron Burgundy and team went toe-to-toe with Wes Mantooth's Chargers. Give it up for the monarch of the Midlands, Will O'Callaghan.
Morning, lads. Shane O'Donnell role set for me yesterday. Nathan Murphy apparently had some golf major to watch, so he was unable to take part in the final against RTE Sports. So I was parachuted in with mixed results yesterday, but we eventually, and people can watch it on the Sport for Business YouTube page this morning, we eventually overcame RTE on a final round tiebreaker with a certain amount of shithousery with the way that we answered the final question too. But hey, they weren't able to argue against the poor technique that we used, and we eventually picked up the bragging rights.
Winning in any way possible.
Who
I like
up,
it.
Who are you up against?
The OTB way. So we were up against an RTE team that included Conor Neville once of this parish, which I was seriously questionable about. Raf Diallo apparently was going to be a late replacement. Again, I think the idea was to use former OTB staff against us, which didn't happen in the end. And as it worked out, lads, we brought it right down to the final question because they had come back in the final round. We made this sterling start. We went 8-0 up in the sporting questions. We then lost the round almost entirely on the entertainment. Sport history, we did okay. And then on the general knowledge, we were useless again. Got caught, think it squared at about 20 points each at the final. Then we had to pick out how many attacks Italy had in the European Championships was the final question. And RTE, unfortunately, because they had to come back in the final round, they had to guess first, and they made a noble effort by saying, you know, a couple of hundred attacks. And then we realised pretty quickly, I think I'd seen a stat where Spain had 97 in three games alone. So UEFA are pretty liberal in how they actually mark down an attack. And so at that stage, I reckon there was no point in us going for some kind of high number where we could potentially be wrong. And I went a bit like some of the old TV game shows and said, look, we'll just go higher. We won't give you a number. And I think RTE were absolutely screwed by us not having to vote. But hey, hopefully we'll have a stronger quizmaster for this one.
No, I mean, that's absolutely for sure. That's, I don't know who that quizmaster is. And thank you for plugging other quizzes on YouTube. This is the only quiz on YouTube that matters, Will O'Callaghan.
You can watch it after this one.
I mean, no, people can't do two things ever. It's just, their entire life revolves around this quiz. Will, you're very welcome to the quiz. The stakes are pretty high for you after yesterday's win. And our next contestant today was on the OTB team in the Super Quiz, but got ditched in brutal fashion before the final. Why on earth did this Mayo man from Mayo, the county of Mayo, get ditched for such an important final? I guess we'll never know. Give it up for the beast of Ballyhaunis, Nate Dog Murphy.
Well, there wasn't wine and canapes on offer for the final, so as you know, if there's not, I ain't going to be there.
Our last contestant today was never at any point called to the OTB team for this Super Quiz, but those who are 14th on the standby list have an important role to play too. Keeping the A team on their toes, it's Adrian. Who's your daddy, Barry?
Cheap but fair.
I wasn't asked up either, Adrian. So I feel your pain. I feel your pain. It's the two of us here in studio with two brainier people by all accounts on Skype. But we get it, lads. It's okay. As ever, the format is a classic crappy quiz with a series of questions on a range of themes. Then it's on to the slip and slide of trivia, which is the rapid fire round. You can podcast the crappy quiz on otbsports.com or on the OTB Sports app. And if you're watching on YouTube, make sure to click the thumbs up, even if we're contributing nothing but misery to your day. And then please send any questions you have, by the way, via postcard to Crappy Quiz Quizmaster, Off the Ball Towers, Marconi House, Diggs Lane, Dublin 2. Round one is the boring questions round. Never multiple choice. Will, Kilkenny went through the front door on every occasion when they won their four in a row of All-Ireland titles in the 2000s. But can you name the last Leinster champions before Kilkenny's mid-decade dominance and the first Leinster champions after their dominance ended?
Okay, I think Wexford are the team before them.
Correct.
And it's either going to be Dublin or Galway. I think it's Galway.
Correct. Will O'Callaghan off the mark. Nathan Murphy's making very funny.
It's a very a very convoluted way of asking an easy question.
How do you frame it?
Well, just give them the 2 years and who won the Leinster title in these years.
But then that would simplify it a little bit more. I didn't want to give away the years.
The only thing worse than the question is now analysing the question.
The point is you've got to guess the years and then fill in the blanks with the years as well. It's a two-step answer. I appreciate your brain maybe just warming up this morning. And question one for you. There were a logjam of four players on four goals at the Euros this year. Who were the four players?
Romelu Lukaku, Harry Kane, Forsberg.
One more.
I don't think he did he? I think Spain got there.
Yeah, no, come on, Ed, give us your time usual limit there.
There's not a time limit here. I think of four answers.
Yeah, no, give us your
spiel. I was about you shut up for a minute, let me think about it.
Well, that's not really how it works. Have you ever been on the quiz before?
I don't think I only got three, but I'm going to say it because I can't think of anyone.
Cycle of knowledge, Nathan. Come on, you know the drill.
Well, I was going to do the did your man Seferovic get three or four?
It's all right, the stream finishes at 10.
So, none of the Germans, was there?
Come on.
Italy. You're just naming random countries now, Owen. This is surely a time.
Chiesa? No, it's not Chiesa. The one you're missing is Karim Benzema.
Benzema, so I was going to go for it. I thought he only got three.
Adrian, with only two national caps, Marcus Smith is now the least experienced international player in this current Lions squad. Can you name the player with the second fewest international caps in the squad?
Oh, I can.
Sound like you're convincing yourself there.
No. Simmons.
Correct. Seven caps. Eddie Jones not a fan. Sam Simmons, well done. Adrian off the mark, Will off the mark after round one. Round two is the open round. Another golf major spells another opportunity to ask you questions about said major, allowing golf nerd Nathan Murphy to puff his chest out and feel like a giant amongst men. Will, who finished second to Shane Lowry in 2019?
Tommy Fleetwood.
Correct. Nathan, can you name the last Englishman to win the Open on English soil? That was impressively quick, Will. Fair play.
It was.
I was watching that one pretty intently, lads.
You're right. The greatest moment in the history of Offaly.
That is a good point. Will could probably give you the top 100 players. I don't mind about who finished that.
Yeah. He's probably staring at the
printout of the leaderboard.
It comes up in every single Sunday show he does in Midlands. Let's remind ourselves again of Shane Lowry.
It's all good this time of year, particularly.
Last Englishman to win on English soil.
You know, the worst part is if Nathan Murphy had been watching yesterday's OTBM, he'd probably know this.
We're not even getting the cycle of bullshit that we normally get, which is concerning for him.
I'm just going through the various English players, none of whom have won us. And I'm trying to... Faldo.
No. Not Faldo. Faldo won all his on Scottish soil. Tony Jacklin. In 1969 was the answer.
Is Tony Jacklin not Welsh?
Tony Jacklin, it very much says English. Every bit of research I've done. I mean, you throw these curveballs out at me, and then like it forces me to actually go and actually.
You hit me with a question, and I'll eyes English.
Anthony Jacklin,
you're right.
CBE, is a retired English golfer.
You're right.
Anyway, Adrian. Other than Padraig Harrington, can you name any other golfer that has won the Open exactly twice?
Ernie Els.
Correct. Ernie Els.
Good answer.
Could have given me Lee Trevino, Arnold Palmer, Greg Norman as well. And then if you go way back, Harold Hilton, Willie Park Jr. and Bob Martin as well.
About Willie Park Sr. actually, but...
Yeah. But thankfully Els came to mind. Round three is the I've always been an archery fan round. It is almost Olympic Games time. We are 1 week until Tokyo. Here is a collection of questions about the Games. Will... Novak Djokovic, hoping to go one step closer to completing the Golden Slam at this year's Olympics. Can he name the only tennis player to have already completed the Golden Slam?
Andy Murray?
No. Anyone? It was mentioned quite a bit last week in relation to the Djokovic coverage. Steffi Graf is the answer. Nathan, The Olympic Games have been held in three different cities across the United States. Can you name them?
Atlanta.
That's one.
Los Angeles.
That's two.
No, everybody's listening to us this morning. We haven't disappeared off air. We're still here. Nathan's making a lot of scared faces.
Apologies. But see, I don't want to be running through all the just the cities of America.
That'd be your usual approach, just name a load of cities. Come on.
Don't need to push you here. What is the answer?
Come on.
Boston?
No. Anyone?
San Francisco?
No.
Summer Games only, is it?
Yeah, St. Louis.
St. Louis, yeah.
1904. Nathan, Adrian, can you name any of the new events at Tokyo 2020?
Yeah.
This tactic of saying yes before even the answer actually worked out last time, so... What are you thinking?
I'm thinking that it's like, without giving me my answer, I think it's skateboarding. nothing that has happened on the screen right there has given me any indication as to whether that's a good path to follow. Was that there already? Oh, yay, yay.
Come on. Just give a bloody answer.
I think that, I think...
Big moment.
Oh,
you can go 3 points clear of Nathan here.
Was there breakdancing or something like that?
Oh, was there breakdancing? Who knows?
I think there might have been something crazy like that. If only Jojo was on this morning. I'm going to go with...
Gotta need an answer.
I'm going to go with skateboarding.
Correct.
Yeah.
Skateboarding, karate, baseball or softball, surfing...
Karate.
And sport climbing. Or bouldering, I would have accepted.
Oh, bouldering, of course.
Any and
what's bouldering?
It's a little part subset of sport climbing. I would have accepted it as a different phraseology, but you did not need that. Skateboarding is skateboarding, as we all know. There's no other way of putting it. Adrian Barry, you're on 3 points. Will O'Callaghan, you're on 2 points.
Clean sweep.
Nathan, you're on 0 points. Oof. But there is plenty of time to change that, because round four is the fun three magic number round. Contestants get 3 points for getting the number exactly right. If no one manages that, the nearest contestant who doesn't go bust gets 2 points. The second closest gets 1 point. I'm going to state that we can only accept the answer that's written on your paper, and I'm going to have to ask for your pens once the music ends. So if you don't mind, give us the following number. The number of points Dublin had to spare in victory over Meath in last year's Leinster final, plus the number of times Tiger Woods has won the Open, plus the number of times Alan Wynne-Jones has been a Lions tourist, plus the number of Irish boxers going to the 2020 Olympics. Your 30 seconds expire when Sinatra sings Bright Shiny Beads. So, the number of points Dublin beat Meath by in the Leinster final last year, the number of claret jugs Tiger Woods has, the number of Lions tours that Alan Wynne-Jones has been part of, and then how many boxers have qualified for the Olympics for Ireland. There was an OFI press release on Wednesday, so I'm getting my figures off that.
Not from Wikipedia.
Not from Wikipedia. All figures are not from Wikipedia. Nathan.
29.
Will.
27.
Adrian.
27.
Nathan Murphy back in the game. It's 35.
Ooh, yes.
So, Nathan, so you both went 27.
Yeah,
so you both get a point then, Nathan. You get 2 points.
Ah, really?
Yeah, that's how it works, Nathan.
It's going to have to be. Let's go through these. Dublin beat Meath by 21 points in the Leinster final last year. Tiger Woods has won the Open 3 times, 2000, 05, 06. Alan Wynne-Jones has been on 4 Lions tours, 09, 13, 17, and now 21. And the number of Irish boxers going to the 2020 Olympics is 7. Brendan Irvine, Kurt Walker, Aidan Walsh, Emmett Brennan, Michaela Walsh, Kelly Harrington and Aoife O'Rourke brings your total to 35. Nathan, you're back in it on 2 points. Will, you're on 3 points. Adrian Barry is on 4 points. It is.
He can only blow it from here.
Good showing so far, Nathan. You'd have to agree.
All the talk from Adrian Barry.
Yeah. I haven't said anything.
Can he get the job done?
I haven't said anything. Just giving confident and correct answers is all that's happened so far. Oof.
It is the rapid fire round. It is an old team in particular. Ridiculously easy rapid fire round to give it its full title. The score you get in this round will be added to your score in the previous round. There will be 40 seconds for everyone to answer from the same set of questions. So we're going to start with Adrian, then on to Will, then on to Nathan. And if you get a question correct, I will keep asking you questions until you get one wrong. And that incorrect answer will also mean the deduction of 1 point. And then I move on to the next person. So, Adrian Barry, are you ready?
I am.
Your 40 seconds starts now. Name the Antrim senior hurling manager.
Liam Cahill.
No, Darren Gleeson. Tampa Bay Lightning compete in what sport, Will?
Baseball?
No, ice hockey. Ryan Bertrand signed for which club this week, Nathan?
Leicester.
Correct. Lewis Rees-Sammet plays for what club?
Gloucester.
Correct. Who did Meath beat in the 2010 Leinster football final?
Louth.
Correct. In what decade did Tokyo last host the Summer Games?
60s.
Correct. Who was the last Italian to score in the Euro 2020 final shootout?
Panucci.
Too long. Bernadeschi. What nationality is Tour de France sensation Tadej Pogacar? Adrian.
Chilean.
No, Slovenian. Which means you've also been deducted 1 point. You went into it on 4, you end up on 2.
Yeah.
Will, you went into it on 3, you end up on 2. Nathan, you went into it on 2, 3, 4, 5. Back to 4.
That's impressive.
Nathan Murphy on 4 points.
Sorry, I went all the way to 6 and then I went
five.
Back to 5,
you
by
got
the
five,
way.
Yeah,
on to 5. I keep getting that right. Doesn't matter, you're the winner.
Does not matter.
Oh, and you'd have to say, look,
do you know what Adrian Barry's like? Adrian Barry, if Adrian like Barry's an English footballer, if Adrian Barry's an English footballer, he'd be taking a penalty because, you know, he would have done well in practice when there was no pressure on. Gareth Southgate would be like, I can trust this guy. When there's no pressure on whatsoever, this guy's really good. But actually, when it matters, on the big occasion, he can't.
It's Mayo football. Come on, you know that's the easiest comparison. And, like, I would say, listen, congratulations, Nathan, on your win. But you would absolutely have to say that the questions you got, some of those, you got the 60s. I think that was probably the pick of them. Outside of that, they were 2 yard tackles.
Sorry, so
well done.
You know what club Ryan Bertrand signed for?
Yeah.
What club did he sign for?
Mm.
It's literally just been said. I mean, give me, you know.
And that answer was
Leicester City. Come on.
We
had this nonsense
from?
With Luke Ayling before, so we're not going back down that road. But like, it was pretty much the only signing, the confirmed signing of the week for like the resident football expert. That was a 2 yard tap in.
Louis Rees-Sammet plays for what team?
Yeah, Gloucester. Yeah, that was a 2 yard tap in.
Gloucester was a good one for Nathan.
What question
for Nathan?
Question
you're right. My one was very hard, actually.
Where's
Pogacar from? You wouldn't have got that. Not a chance.
You wouldn't have. Probably would have got that. Adrian, Will, commiserations. Nathan Murphy, back-to-back champ.
I tell you, there wouldn't have even been a playoff against RTE if I was there for the final. It would have been an absolute demolition.
But I didn't want to go in a battle of the egos.
Listen, when they're offering those 100 grand a year gigs, Will, you're going to be remembered as the problem now in RTE. Like, this guy. Really?
Give me that gold plated pension, lads.
All right, that is it for us this morning. OTB AM is brought to you every morning by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors.
OTB AM. With Gillette, put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.